This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, Scotch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films 10 Cloverfield Lane, The Brothers Grimsby, Boom Bust Boom, and The Final Project. I'm also going to be talking about the news, Trailer Park, some box office predictions, and the home cinema roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
First thing I want to talk about is the fact that the second Wachowski sibling or brother, you know, Andy Wachowski, has come out as transgender, and he was kind of forced out, actually, by the Daily Mail in the UK. He is now known as Lily Wachowski. So Lily and Lana is who Andy and Larry were, and that's who they are now. They're the same people. They're making movies, you know, their own personal decisions. You know, they get to do what they want to. It's shame that you get dragged out like that sometimes, and that's considered in very poor taste, but the news is out there, and Lily Wachowski is the new Andy. And you know, hey, I teach their own, in my opinion. If that's what makes you happy, that's what makes you happy. And from a filmmaking perspective, the two of them are still making movies. I don't know if they're going to make anything big again, because Jupiter Ascending did not do very well, and neither did Cloud Atlas. But I've always found them to be very innovative filmmakers. I'd love to see them do more. I haven't gotten through Sense 8 on Netflix. It's a little bit slow of a burn, and it's a bit dense. But one of these days I'm going to do it. I've always enjoyed the Wachowskis' filmmaking. I will probably continue to enjoy the Wachowskis' filmmaking. It doesn't matter what gender they are. The next piece I want to talk about news-wise is this has shown up again and again as an option. And some people are always pushing for this. In terms of movie releases, you have the big theaters that show the film, and then it goes to video on demand and at home cinema later. Well, a new concept of day and date pay-per-view on demand movies has been suggested again, with this technology being pioneered by Sean Parker, who's best known for creating Napster, which I find kind of interesting that the guy who created Napster, which kind of brought the music industry to its knees in the early part of the 20th century, is now trying to revolutionize the distribution of movies. Now, the deal that he's trying to put together is this new, it's going to be a new piece of technology you can bring to your homes, and supposedly $150. It's got all the latest anti-piracy features, and what this group wants to do is to be able to release movies on the day that they opened in theaters, but you'd pay like $50 for 48-hour rental. And the reason for the high premium is because you wouldn't be going to the theater. And of course, you can bring friends over. So if you bring 10 friends over, everybody pays $5, and it's a lot cheaper than going to a theater for $10, $15, $20. Here's the problem, and this has always been the problem with this sort of exhibition format. First of all, not all of the studios are behind this. Disney supposedly is noticeably absent in their interest in this sort of product. And it makes sense, because they've got two of the biggest tentpole franchises out there. You're talking about Star Wars and Marvel, both of which not only are the big budget in the theaters movies, these are the kind of movies that do well in IMAX. They're the ones that do well in 3D. They're the ones that command the highest box office potential that first weekend. If you don't have Disney aboard something like this, it better be so unstoppable they'll eventually come aboard, or you're going to see it collapse. Now, the other problem with this, and this has always been the problem, this is the anti-piracy technology they're talking about. It's not going to last long. Supposedly, the selling point is it has all these anti-piracy protections, and that way you won't see versions of it showing up on Pirate Bay and other BitTorrent sites. which you will, because first of all, nothing I think is stopping anyone from putting a camera in their living room and videotaping the screen. Granted, you don't get a pristine picture, but that's not going to stop people from downloading a less than perfect image of it. Second of all, if it's technology, it can be hacked, and it will be hacked extremely quickly. No matter what kind of piracy software you put on there, it's going to be hacked and people will get a workaround and it will show up on sites. And you're just making it easier. Because nowadays, if you want to pirate a film that's out in full release, you either have to get it from the studio, get some sort of inside job, or you have to get a camera into a movie theater that's not 3D, that's not IMAX, and be able to record it that way. Now you can just do it in the privacy of your own home and control the environment. But even so, this is never going to go for big films. A movie like Batman vs. Superman is never going to be something that they want to release day and date in homes, because they are relying on the IMAX and the 3D and the drive to the cinemas for that movie's success. It's going to be smaller movies like, say, Daddy's Home, which was kind of a big hit over Christmas, but I don't know if anyone's willing to pay $50 for that. People certainly would pay $50 to see the new Star Wars movie at home when it came out in theaters, but there's not a lot of people that are going to be wanting to go see, like I'm talking about this weekend, the Brothers Grimsby. No one's going to pay $50 for that. They tossed this idea around a while ago when Tower Heist came out, and the director, Brett Ratner, was like, well, maybe if we do this pay-per-view a week ahead of time, you can see it at home. Not only do you have all the piracy issues, but you're hedging your bet that people wanted to see Tower Heist early. And I don't know if people really did. Ultimately, this is already happening with small independent distributors like Magnolia and IFC have been doing not only day and date releases on demand, but you can sometimes see these movies on demand before they even come out in theaters by several weeks. And that's because these are not big releases and they're not paid $50. They're like, you know, maybe $10-$12 for a release, which is what, you know, the cost of a ticket is. But the big ones, they're never going to release Star Wars like this, even if Disney came aboard. The next piece of news I want to hit really quickly is Peter Capaldi. I talked about this a while back, that he is Doctor Who right now, and he was supposed to be leaving the show when the new showrunner came in. Well, now the new showrunner has come in and asked him to stay, which means we would get more of Peter Capaldi as Doctor Who, which I think actually is kind of good. Breaking completely can be a little bit daunting. I think they've lost a little bit of American interest, at least. But in the end, I love Doctor Who, and I'd love to see a little bit of a resurgence and a continuation of Peter Capaldi. I felt he was driven a little bit into the ground with Stephen Moffat, but you know, hey, new blood maybe can bring some new good stuff with the show. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's roll into the trailer park. No, I'm not going to talk about Captain America Civil War, the new trailer of Spider-Man. You can't see him on the radio anyways, so why am I even bothering on that? Here's the thing, when it comes to movies like this, so much buzz surrounds them, I like to insulate myself, and I'm going into blackout mode with the Marvel movies this summer, just because I kind of don't want everything spoiled. I'm going quiet on that one. I'll talk about that more when it's released in about 2 months. Instead, I'm going to only cover one because we are limited with time, and that is Ice Age Collision Course, opens on July 22nd.
Hey, look, shooting stars!
Quick, make a wish! You gotta make a wish!
Wow, my wish came true.
I'm okay!
Mine too.
Meteor shower!
Meteor shower?
The mother of all asteroids screaming towards us, but I've got a plan.
Who's with me?
Crashing Eddie, reporting for duty.
Duty. I've actually avoided talking about this one for a couple weeks simply because it's such a hodgepodge trailer. I was able to put together something that sounds somewhat remotely understandable, but really this movie is a scattershot of jokes, and that's what the Ice Age movies have turned into. They've lost their semblance of telling a coherent story, which you got in the first film. And if you look at the critical scores, they've kind of all dipped down as they've gone later on. And the box office, at least in America, has dipped down. The box office internationally has exploded, and that's the reason why they're continuing to make them. I like Scrat, but I think the rest is going to be just kind of a mess. Anyways, that is it for this segment. I need to go to a break, and when I come back, I'm going to be talking about the Brothers Grimsby and the final project. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's roll into the movie reviews. We've got a couple of them to talk about. Let's start off with The Brothers Grimsby. Two brothers are separated as orphans. One becomes an MI6 agent and the other becomes a bumbling football fan, and they reunite to stop an act of global terrorism.
We finally found your brother. He's gonna be at this posh event tomorrow.
Eyes on the target.
Finally, I can make things right.
Nobby? Oh my god.
Take him out!
Because of you,
my shot was compromised!
A huge manhunt to find the rogue secret agent.
How can I help?
Stay away from me.
Don't worry, brother. I won't leave you!
This stars Sacha Baron Cohen and Mark Strong. And Mark Strong's an incredibly versatile actor. I'm a huge fan of Mark Strong. He's not a name or a face that you put on posters that people will go run out and see a movie with him in it. But he's been in a lot of big movies, and he's been in a lot of flops as well. But boy, he's a great actor, and he's versatile. He can play a really hard-nosed guy, but he can also play, comedy as well. And I think this is actually great for Mark Strong. Maybe not, because I don't think the movie's going to do well. But it's great for Mark Strong because it does show that he has a lot of prowess as a comedian, and he can do he can play the straight man. And if you go back to the classic duos, like even, like Abbott and Costello, Bud Abbott was the straight man, and straight men were revered, especially, 100 years ago, because they were not easy to get. A straight man is not an easy, anybody can play the fool, but the straight man is what grounds the comedy. And he does this really well with Sacha Baron Cohen because he plays the fool. And of course, he's known for playing Borat and Bruno and Dolly G. And he plays his own new character, but he's a complete idiot. And he relies on the slapstick comedy. But like I said, Mark Strong grounds this movie. Now, I'm not going to lie to you. The comedy in this film is extremely lowbrow. The comedy in this film is at times offensive. There's things in this movie that it was shocking because they're jokes and things that happen that become jokes that you normally would not want to joke about in a movie. This is normally what turns off an audience. And I can see, in my mind's eye, the test audiences ticking off and saying, well, we didn't like this. We didn't like this. You shouldn't have done this. You shouldn't have done this to this. And that's true. It's a very offensive comedy at times, and unapologetic. And at times it's just crass and sexually graphic, but I found that funny. It's incredibly lowbrow. It is not at all, even something like, I had somebody once compare it to me to Blazing Saddles. Blazing Saddles, yeah, they had some crass moments, but this takes it even lower. Now, I thought it was funny. I enjoyed it. I thought the shocking and sometimes very easy humor was pretty hilarious. But if you're not into that, you're not going to like this movie. I personally found it funny, but I'm probably going to be in the minority. And it's not even that the gross out humor is going to turn people off, which it will. I mean, I'm not going to go take my mom to this movie, but the very, shocking moments are the stuff that would normally offend people and say, well, you really can't do that because this is a bad thing happening to an animal or a person or an innocent person. And you have to just frame this movie in the context of it's not real and it's meant to be ridiculous. And I think it achieves that. I just don't know how well it's going to connect to a wide audience. But ultimately, I'm going to have to say, I thought the Brothers Grimsby kind of rocked.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's roll into the next review, and that is The Final Project. A group of college students investigate a supposedly haunted house in the woods.
Is this on? We're going to see if this plantation is really haunted, but I'm going because I need the extra credit.
Honey, you don't want no parts of that place. Ain't nothing good about it.
As soon as you set foot in that place, you'll understand why you need to get in that van, turn it around, and go back to where you come from!
Whatever is in there is not there.
What is that?
Carl!
Please. Please help me.
This is a really small movie. Admittedly, this is a very, very small movie, but it's getting a release. And it actually came out in my hometown of Columbus, Ohio. The problem is it's really not good. And the reason it's not good is it's a found footage movie. And I have a long history of saying how much I disdain found footage and how I think it's ruined the horror genre in a lot of ways. Mainstream horror has been turned into a joke because of found footage. This isn't even just me railing at found footage, but everything about this movie can be traced back to the found footage genre because it's so ineptly done. Most found footage movies start, even the trailer you hear it start out, oh, is this thing on kind of thing. That's how every single found footage movie starts. But this just takes all the cliches and wraps them up together. I remember once when I was younger, you know, I would say, I think I was dating my wife at the time, and we went and saw a magic show at an amusement park. And there's this trick, and it's called the metamorphosis. It's a famous trick, and it's spectacular when you see it done well. And if it's done well, you almost can't figure out how it's done. It's that skillful of a trick. But I saw it done on stage at this Geauga Lake up in Aurora, Ohio, which doesn't even exist anymore. And it was done so ineptly and poorly that it basically showed me how it was completely done. And it was sort of disappointing because I loved the trick and I could never figure it out. But then when I saw it done poorly, it revealed basically the trick behind it. And that's kind of what this movie is. It's so poorly done from a found footage standpoint. It's poorly lit. It's poorly written. It's poorly acted. It's not even well shot. These people are supposed to be at least a certain degree of quality because they're documentarians. Like in a movie like The Sacrament that came out a couple of years ago, part of the reason that worked as a found footage movie is because the characters in the story had a certain amount of filmmaking experience, so it didn't look all herky-jerky and shaky. This one, they're supposed to, but they're not even lit. It literally looks like I gave a couple of my son, who's 14, I gave him a video camera, no lights, and said, just go, you know, randomly shoot something in the woods and you'll get it. The acting is terrible. It's way overacted. The character points are ridiculously done. There's no special effects in the movie at all. It's all just them running around, throwing the camera around. And the production value is so low that it's shocking, especially knowing what is capable of with low budget filmmaking today. On an iPhone, you can shoot a better film than this just by using your idiot proof camera. And this is just inept is the word. Inept in putting it together and the story. There really is no, they just go out to this haunted house and they run into the crazy woman at the store warning them. It takes all the cliches, throws them in this blender and hits frappe. And then they just splatter it up on screen with no coherence whatsoever. And the characters, there's no building of characters. They're just all a bunch of jerks and they repeat and repeat and repeat. And you can tell they're improvising their dialogue because they're not very good at it. You know, remember the Blair Witch Project? Remember how terribly acted that was? Same thing, only worse. The Final Project is not a good movie. It is everything that's wrong with found footage, and done so ineptly, it shows all the flaws. The Final Project sucks.
It sucks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about 10 Cloverfield Lane and Boom Bust Boom. Take a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare.
In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, continuing with the movie reviews. We're going to talk about 10 Cloverfield Lane. And by the way, that's the music you're hearing here. This is from the score by Barry McCreary. Both the bumpers from the last break and this one is from 10 Cloverfield Lane. You can download that, or, you know, can you buy stuff at the record store anymore? Can you go into a like Best Buy and get a CD? I don't even know if you can anymore. But you can get it online. But this is the soundtrack. It's actually pretty intense. In fact, the soundtrack in this movie is one of the cool things about it. It has a sort of Hitchcock feel to it. You know, there's some innovative stuff going on with soundtracks nowadays. And there's throwbacks, not just to the 80s. We did the Eddie the Eagle soundtrack I played last week. But this week, they've got this one, which goes back to sort of a 60s Hitchcockian feel, and that really sets the mood. So as the mood is set, let's talk about 10 Cloverfield Lane. A woman finds herself kept prisoner in an underground bunker after her captor tells her there's been an attack on the surface.
Something's coming.
Probably the most interesting part of this movie isn't even necessarily the movie itself. While the movie's good, I'm not going to bury the lead here. The movie's, it's a good movie. It's definitely worth checking out. But sort of the story behind the story in this film. This was originally called The Cellar, I think, and it was sort of retrofitted into this Cloverfield model. If you remember Cloverfield from 7 or 8 years ago, J.J. Abrams produced it, and it was that one about the American kaiju monster, this monster that comes down and starts attacking New York City, and it was found footage, and I just railed on found footage on the last segment, but Cloverfield sort of pioneered it in terms of the big budget found footage. Yeah, you had stuff like Blair Witch, and there was some stuff happening in the independent circles with people doing found footage as soon as video cameras became a viable alternative to shooting on film. But this was the first one that actually started to use big budget and heavy special effects. And then, of course, the industry sort of was killing its golden goose by making them just crappy horror movies that never really quite worked. But that one was shrouded in mystery. I remember they dropped the trailer in front of Transformers, I believe, in the summer. And then it came out in January, nobody knew anything about it. And they kind of did the same thing here. They developed this movie called The Cellar, and then they released it as 10 Cloverfield Lane. The trailer dropped like 2 months ago, and it took everyone by surprise because J.J. Abrams used the shroud of Star Wars that everyone was focusing on with him. That's where his name was getting all the buzz. And he was able to fly this little movie he produced under the radar and drop it into the beginning of 2016, and that was a feat, because it's really hard to do anything secret nowadays in Hollywood with the way the internet and journalism is today. But the name Cloverfield is more meant to sort of tie it together. It's not a direct sequel. Don't go to this movie expecting them to burst out of the bunker and you see the giant Cloverfield monster throwing things around. That's not what this movie is, because it takes place 8 years later. Is this monster still wandering around 8 years later? You know, nobody knows what happened. And this is not a direct sequel. You're not going to get all the answers to the questions you had with the first Cloverfield. It's more the spirit of the movie. And they've come out and said very clearly, it's not Cloverfield 2. But there's certain connective tissue in the spirit and the feel and the nature of the film. It being essentially kind of this Twilight Zone type movie. And it's not found footage, which is good. But it's really just, it's kind of like a bottle episode of a television show. It all takes place in this bunker. It's a very intimate, limited movie, and you know, it's got Mary Elizabeth Winstead playing the woman who's the captive, essentially. She wakes up chained to the wall. You're pretty much a captive. If you wake up anywhere chained to a wall, you're a captive. And you've got John Goodman, who does a fantastic performance as this guy who he's like, I've saved you, your life. I brought you down. There's been some attack up topside, and I'm keeping you safe down here. And aren't you thankful to me? And he does a fantastic job because there's a lot of nuance there. He does just a great performance. And when you only have just a couple people in a room, because there's another guy in the bunker with them, they have three people. They're carrying the movie. For 90% of the film, it's the three of them. I don't want to say much more than that, because this is the kind of movie that's best experienced cold. Stay away from the internet. Don't start looking up reviews, because people in my field are idiots and they will try and spoil things in a braggadocious, I saw it first sort of way. So yeah, 10 Cloverfield Lane totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the next film, which is Boom Bust Boom. Monty Python's Terry Jones takes us through the background of the 2008 financial crisis and why it is likely to happen again.
Human nature drives the economy to crisis after crisis, time and time again.
Every generation thinks it's smarter than its parents and its grandparents.
People tend to repeat the mistakes of the past.
Everyone was convinced that this time it's different.
The last financial crisis recedes into the fog of memory, and that sets you up for the next one. Negative equity
takedown. I always have to be a little bit skeptical whenever I see a movie that's going to be about, not politics, this really isn't a political movie, but it's certainly about stuff that is politically charged. And documentaries can be so iffy now and then, and I blame that all on Michael Moore. And as entertaining as a filmmaker as he can be, Michael Moore has kind of ruined documentaries. And it's nice to see somebody like Terry Jones and the folks involved in Boom Bust Boom sort of abandon the Michael Moore filmmaking model, which the Michael Moore filmmaking model is coming in with a very specific point of view, putting yourself up as this whimsical character, investigating it, and coming up to your conclusions that you've already had before you made the movie. What Terry Jones does, and Terry Jones definitely can see he has influence on this because he has that Monty Python edge to it, the sort of absurdist approach to it. And he tells the story and he has these puppets and they do some cool animation. That's where it really feels Monty Python-ish, but it takes it very seriously. And he makes a point to not just go after the Americans, but to go after the bankers in England and the bankers elsewhere in charge of this complete financial meltdown. Now, it takes a lot of dense material. Whenever you take sort of that financial information, you're trying to distill it around for the average person to watch. It's very difficult because there's numbers and figures and trends that are kind of boring to people. And I mean, it's not like The Big Short. This is not Margot Robbie in a bubble bath trying to explain this. That's always nice. But it does have The Economist explaining the ups and downs of financial market and the human flaws that go into it, which causes it to happen. Capitalism is imperfect. The way, and I was explaining this to my son because he mentioned communism, and I said, well, the reason communism doesn't work, it works well on paper, but human nature gets involved and there's human flaws, and that's what causes communism to completely fall apart. Capitalism is more stable, but there's still human flaws that feed the system and cause problems. And that's why you get rises and falls and busts and why you have predatory lending and people not seeing it coming. There's a lot of arrogance and ego involved. But one thing it does show, and I'm going to say this now, I'm going to go on record right now and say the next big financial crisis, based on what they talk about in this movie, because they look at the stock market crash and they look at the housing crash and they look at like the tulip market crash and the railroad crash that happened historically. Whenever you have people are paying more and more and oftentimes borrowing to get that with the hopes of what they've borrowed to buy is going to have a greater return, that's what builds a crash. And you know where that's happening right now is in college tuition. No one wants to come out and say that college degrees oftentimes are worthless, but they are. Not all of them, but some of them are. And as great as education is, people are borrowing heavily to buy the stock of their education on margin, hoping that they'll be able to return. But if you spend $100,000 to get a history degree, you're never going to make that money back. You're going to have a collapse in the financial system of student loans and the university system. Mark my words, that's the next one's coming. And I've learned it from boom, bust, boom. And the movie itself rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Childhood's End, the box office, and the home cinema roundup. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Back, guys, at the movies with Kevin Carr, rolling into the final segment with one more review. Now, it's a slightly different review. I normally don't cover TV, and it's not that I have anything against TV. I just don't have time to cover TV. There's so much TV, and now that you've got not just the main networks, but you've got stuff from cable that's emerged, and now you've got PBS that's emerged, you know, Downton Abbey and Sherlock and all this stuff, the BBC imports, Doc Martin. And on top of it, you've got now Netflix and Hulu and Amazon Prime all developing their own shows. There's no way to catch up on all this. I do movies. I don't do TV. But every now and then I cover TV. If it's something that interests me, I talked about Doctor Who in the earlier segment. But I want to talk about the miniseries Childhood's End. And part of this is from a recommendation from Bob P. And my apologies, Bob. You emailed me like in December, like before Christmas, because that's when it was airing on the Sci-Fi Channel. And I'm extremely busy at Christmas. I was like, I'm going to try and get to it because he was asking what I thought of Childhood's End. And I said, I'll try and get to it. I haven't the time this week. And I put it off and I said, well, let's talk about it when the Blu-ray comes out. And the Blu-ray just recently dropped. So Bob P, here you go. Here's my review of it. A race of aliens visit Earth to create a utopia, but a select few begin to question their motivations and true identities.
My name is Karelin. I am the supervisor for Earth.
The overlords talk about peace, but this is an invasion.
Look at the good here. There is no war, no disease.
I would rather the world went down under our control and flourished under theirs.
This is based on the classic book by Arthur C. Clarke of the same name, Childhood's End, came out in the 50s. And I read this. I mean, I read this years ago. I think I was in high school when I read this. So I don't remember anything about it. It's just, and it was also very much written like it was in the 50s. There's some authors like Clifford Simak and Isaac Asimov back in science fiction. They had a very breezy style that made them very easy to read. But some of the stuff from the 50s is a little hard to get through. And it's just not written with the same kind of sensibilities. And so the book's a good book, if I recall, but it is a little bit structured very much in a 50s style. You know, even Isaac Asimov's stuff, like if you read the Foundation books, Isaac Asimov's style wasn't as smooth as it became once you got sort of this mass market taste of fast food writing with that like people like Stephen King kind of helped pioneer in the 70s and 80s. So I remember reading this a long time ago and I remember liking it, but not remembering anything about it. So I was very curious to watch it. I'm essentially experiencing it for the first time, and I remember it being an alien invasion of sorts. Now, the miniseries, it was a three-night event back in December on the Sci-Fi Channel, and it has some neat stuff in it. And, of course, it deals with utopia and humans' reaction to utopia, and it deals with a lot of religious issues, what's evil and what's inherently evil, and whether there is a God and whether you need a God. So it wrestles with some pretty big issues. And they're there in the miniseries. But I think where the miniseries shines the best is in the first episode, where you've got a lot of skeptical humans, where you've got a lot of resistance to these aliens. And they've kind of revealed themselves, but they don't give a full reveal until a little bit later. And that first episode I thought was pretty good. And they have Cole Meany plays with this newspaper, this media magnate who's against the aliens and calls them the overlords and sort of runs a propaganda campaign against them. That stuff is really neat because I think it shows a very relatable human reaction. When you finally get to the full reveal and they pull a couple, you know, I think they go 15 years in the future. It gets a little bit shaky because it's trying to deal with this utopia, and we don't live in a utopia. We don't know how people would react to a utopia, and it felt very false, at least how it's presented here. I my biggest fault in this production is the acting. There's some great characters in it. I mean, like Charles Dance plays Karellen, the main alien, sort of like supervisor of Earth. And like I said, you've got Cole Meany in there. Julian McMahon shows up. So there are some decent performances in it, but there's also, it tends to be populated by this sort of very generic, this very good looking, but very generic TV movie cast of people that I don't expect to see go anywhere else beyond this. And you see this a lot with the Sci-Fi Channel and their casting. They tend to pull from this, this slate of actors who are very attractive, but they look like they came from soap operas. I think it has some neat issues. It makes me want to go back and read the book. And eventually when they finally get to like the last half hour of the miniseries, it gets interesting again, but sort of watching humanity wallow around in utopia got a little bit tiresome at times. So in the end, while I want to go back and read the original book and I respect the heck out of Arthur C. Clarke, the TV version of Childhood's End kind of sucked.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. And was I correct? I predicted that Zootopia was going to win. And I predicted it was going to win with a heftier margin than some. I said $65 million. It did better than that. Zootopia actually topped the box office with $75 million, which, by the way, is the highest opening of a Disney animated film, not Pixar, but the Disney Animation Studios. It's the highest opening ever for a Disney animated feature. A lot of people said it beat Frozen. Well, Frozen was a little bit different. Frozen opened on a Wednesday, so it made like $25 or $30 million before it technically had its opening. And it had its opening in the $60 millions. But when you take the 5 day for Frozen, Frozen still beats Zootopia. And that's just because of the day they opened. So that doesn't mean that this is going to do better than Frozen. Is it going to have the legs that Frozen had? I mean, Frozen made $1 billion and it continued through Christmas. Zootopia is good, but you know, it's got a lot of competition coming up for sort of the family audience. Even if you're talking Batman versus Superman, which is a more of a grown-up movie. But it's still going to face that. But still, I don't want to take anything away from Zootopia. It was a great movie, and it was a lot of fun, and it did extremely well. London Has Fallen came in with $21 million, and that was okay, but not as good as its predecessor. And Whiskey Tango Foxtrot actually came in under expectations with $7.5 million, which, yeah, that's a hard sell for sort of a wartime comedy. And the other side of the door, like I said, it came in 16th. It made just over $1 million. This week, I think Zootopia is going to continue its hold. I think Zootopia is good for another 35 or 40 million. Some people are saying as high as $45, $47 million for Zootopia. And I can see that happen because there, you know, even though there's stuff for everybody out there in the cinemas this weekend, there still isn't anything that's going to be direct competition to Zootopia. You've got 10 Cloverfield Lane. That's not a family movie. Certainly Brothers Grimsby's not. And there's two other releases that I didn't cover. The Young Messiah, which wasn't screened, or The Perfect Match, which wasn't screened. Neither of which are really kids matinee type movies. So I think Zootopia is going to win the weekend, but I think 10 Cloverfield Lane is going to do well. People are guessing the mid-20s. I think it's going to be pretty high. I think it's going to be $30 million. It's got a lot of buzz, and it's very entertaining, and I think it's going to have a little bit of legs. I think there's going to be some people who are disappointed that it's not a sequel to Cloverfield directly, but I think it's still just a good, solid movie that people are going to enjoy. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Just a couple movies to talk about. The Peanuts movie is out on DVD and Blu-ray right now, and this was a charming movie. I love the fact that it really kind of captured the essence of Charles Schulz and the original Peanuts characters. I mean, it really felt like a Peanuts movie. It did not feel like it had been meddled with. And too often you get things that are being meddled with. Some directors like, I want to do my own version of Peanuts. No, they said, we're doing the Charles Schulz version of Peanuts. And you got a very charming movie. It was worth seeing with the kids. And it's worth seeing if you don't have the kids either. It's you know, it'll take you back to when you were a kid. In the Heart of the Sea is also out. That is, of course, the inspiration for Moby Dick. This one I thought was okay. It's overly CGI'd and it gets a little bit long in the middle. Victor Frankenstein is also out, and Victor Frankenstein kind of got a bum rap. And I think it had more to do with release date than anything else. I mean, it came out like in November, if I recall. It didn't come out in October, which is when you should release a Frankenstein movie. I actually saw it in the theater alone because nobody else had bought a ticket. It was a complete bust, and that's kind of a shame because it wasn't a bad movie. It's worth checking out. Daniel Radcliffe as Igor and James McAvoy as Victor Frankenstein. Charles Dance, from who played Karelin in Childhood's End. Don't ever trust this guy because he was the father of Frankenstein in this movie. There's also Macbeth, the Michael Fassbender version of it. It's actually a really grim version of it, but it works. Then The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, Season 1 from Netflix, is now available on DVD. And that's it for this week. I need to go. Next week, I'm going to be talking about the Divergent series, Allegiant, and there's also going to be Miracles from Heaven and The Bronze. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.